Today we have with us Dr. Phil Owens from the Environmental Sciences Department of UNBC. Would you be able to introduce yourself?
Yes. Thanks, Ariel. So, yes, my name is Phil Owens. I'm in the Environmental Science Program at the University of Northern British Columbia. I'm a professor in that program, and I'm also an endowed research chair in landscape ecology, and I do a lot of my research out of the Quesnel River Research Center.
Great. And so today, Professor Owens is here to speak with us about landscape disturbance on sediment in rivers and other various watersheds in British Columbia. So to start, what are some of the primary concerns regarding landscape disturbance on sediment in rivers in BC?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think, first of all, the important thing to recognize is that sediment is derived from erosion of the land surface, such as erosion of topsoils or channel banks or, for example, a road surface. And that obviously the best thing to try and do is, first of all, to try and reduce that erosion. So, for example, the erosion of topsoil is bad for agricultural production of food. If we have erosion of topsoil, it tends to inevitably diminish the productivity of that landscape to produce food. And then if we have a lot of bank erosion, for example, then that causes rivers to migrate across their floodplain, and inevitably that causes the loss of important agricultural or riparian land. So erosion of the landscape is not a good thing. And then if sediment does make its way into a river, then there are a variety of physical problems associated with that sediment. So, for example, we can think of the smothering of important habitats or spawning gravels, or there can be issues of turbidity, which is often a problem for drinking water supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a chemical problem associated with that sediment. For example, there are lots of unwanted chemicals, such as metals and mercury, lead, copper, and a variety of other organic pollutants like pesticides and PCBs, and they often attach themselves to the fine sediment. So if we get sediment coming into a river system, there are physical and chemical problems. And in fact, the United States Environmental Protection Agency has identified sediment as probably one of the main threats to watercourses in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you say some of the main factors contributing to or causing these disturbances are?
Well, really anything that either removes the vegetation cover, which then exposes, for example, soils and the landscape to raindrop erosion and impacts and water flowing over the soil, which is called overland flow, or physical disturbances to soils and the landscape like tillage, anthropogenic activities like mining, construction, building of pipelines, all those sorts of things. So those are sort of the physical disturbances. And historically, there's a long history of us in humanity cutting down the forest cover for agriculture, which typically started about 11,000 years ago, but became really intensive over the last sort of 100 to 150 years. And that's caused a huge amount of erosion and sediment delivery to rivers. But then also other activities like forest harvesting, mining, urban construction, and road construction, as I just mentioned. All of these can influence erosion of the landscape, soil erosion, or they can influence channel erosion. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of information for Canada about the scale of this, but there was a nationwide study, for example, in the United States, that was published in one of the Nature journals a couple of months ago that estimated erosion rates and sediment movement in rivers, and it identified that basically there had been a tenfold increase over the last sort of decade or so because of human activities. And those sort of estimates have been sort of basically humans having a tenfold increase of erosion and sediment transport is pretty much now in keeping with what we know worldwide in terms of the delivery of sediment from the land to the global oceans. And then, of course, it's important to recognize that in addition to the disturbances that I've just described, which are primarily sort of societal, that there's also things like climate change and wildfire as an example, and all of those also increase erosion and sediment transport.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to elaborate on what wildlife are particularly at stake in northern British Columbia due to this?
Well, society is inevitably impacted by this because of the fact that it has on water quality and obviously our ability to drink it. But I think probably it's true to say that most organisms that live in rivers and streams and lakes, from invertebrates to fish, and then the animals that feed on these are impacted by the sediment and the contaminants on that sediment. So in some cases, it's because of the increased turbidity. So that's the reduction really in light. So if you have any organism that requires light to have a, as part of its ecosystem, at certain light conditions, if you have more turbidity in the water, that's a problem. In other cases, if you've got lots of fine sediment coming in, it tends to smother these river gravels, as I mentioned. And then in other cases, it's the chemicals on the sediment themselves. So, for example, copper is a metal that's often associated with sediment. It often binds onto the sediment particles and moves with the sediment. So if it gets into a creek, you tend to have this sort of high copper concentrations. And copper can be a problem for a variety of organisms, not just in terms of it being toxic, but also it affects the behavior. So the chemosensory behavior, for example, of salmon get affected if there's too much copper in a water system. And it means what that means is it can influence its ability to find its natal streams. So that's an example there. And indeed, it's probably true to say that of most concern are the keystone species like salmon, trout, and sturgeon. And in the case of most of these, the problem probably is the smothering of river gravels by the sediments. And what that does is it prevents the flow of water and dissolved oxygen from going into the gravels where you might have eggs. So essentially, the eggs are not able to essentially survive and get released back into the water once they hatch. So, one of the stressors on fish populations in BC is almost certainly fine sediment and pollutants getting into rivers, the pollutants being on the sediment. And, like with most ecosystems, they're highly linked. So, for example, one unexpected development of some of the work we're doing is that we've been asked to provide some advice about the southern resident killer whale population off the Pacific coast, because Chinook salmon represent about 70% of the diet of that population of killer whales. So there's a lot of interest looking at, for example, sediment and pollutant loading into streams as a stressor on Chinook and other anadromous fish, and particularly obviously when they return from the oceans and try and find their way back to their natal headwater streams. And then if they find that essentially there's lots of sediment and contaminants in those systems, it's bad. And then obviously if they lay their eggs in their reds and they're covered by sediment, there's lots of knock-on problems there.
And so would you be able to elaborate specifically on how watersheds are expected to be affected by this?
Well, watersheds are affected by a variety of different pressures. So, for example, we all know that probably climate change is a big problem for most watersheds. They're not receiving the same amount of water, or the timing of that water distribution is different. There's change in the seasonality. And then obviously we've got things like wildfires, and beetle infestations. And then, of course, layered onto that are things like land cover changes, where we go in and we cut down certain types of vegetation. And then obviously resource development. So all of those are pretty big stressors. And there's probably, no large watershed in BC that's not been affected by at least one of those. And in fact, in most big watersheds in BC, probably they're affected by all of the things I've just described at one point in time or another, or in one particular sort of sub part of the watershed or another. And we sort of call that sort of effect of all of these stresses cumulative impacts, with the idea that, perhaps one of those individual stresses may not be particularly bad in its own right, but if you add them all up together, then collectively their impacts are quite considerable. So, if you imagine a watershed like the Nechaco, which is obviously, it drains into to Prince George, we know, for example, that climate's having an impact. There's considerable changes in the amount of precipitation and changes in temperature and the spatial distribution of that water. And then we've got things like forest harvesting. We've got agricultural development around the Vanderhoof area. We've got resource extraction for there's mines. We know there's lots of road infrastructure, and now, of course, there's pipeline development going on as well. Mm-hmm. And then if you add on to that things like the Shovel Lake wildfire that we had a couple of years ago, and then things like pine beetle infestation, it's easy to see why watersheds are seeing evidence of more erosion and sediment transport and delivery into creeks and rivers.
Mm-hmm. And why is the preservation of watersheds important in BC?
Well, it's essential for sustaining both a healthy environment and for the biodiversity. For example, let's just pick water as an example. We know that water is becoming most of our essential resources. You know, without good water and a plentiful supply of water, then humans can't survive. Mm-hmm. We think of Canada and especially BC of having an abundant supply of water. But that's not, really quite true. I mean, we're certainly blessed with good water resources compared to many countries, but we already know that precipitation is changing, and therefore what we need to do is ensure that all the other activities we're having on the landscape don't influence the water resources such that we push them to the point where there's no longer something that we can utilize.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways you think these disturbances can be mitigated?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's some things we can't do. I mean, we cannot very easily or very quickly reverse the effects of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But we can certainly do some things that might mitigate the effects of some of these activities we're doing on the landscape. And obviously, we need resources like food and fiber and metals and energy. So we can't just stop those activities. But what we do need to do is we need to ensure that their impacts are minimal, so that we're not trading off something like resource extraction for minerals or timber harvesting for trees and wood, paper and pulp, for example, and it doesn't have a negative impact on clean water and biodiversity. So we can't, trade off. We should be trading off one thing for the other. So what we need to do is we need to have measures that basically minimize erosion of the landscape, and then if it does occur, what we need to do is we need to have things in place to stop that sediment from reaching watercourses, so buffers, for example. And one of the things that we probably need to do, and we're probably not doing that well in British Columbia, is we need to be monitoring creeks and rivers constantly to ensure that basically the water quality is good, it meets drinking water standards, and that there's not an excessive amount of sediment or pollution getting into streams. And although we do some form of monitoring on some of the big rivers, we've got some monitoring stations on the Fraser, for example, and a little bit on the big rivers like the Thompson on the Chaco, we don't do it typically on a continuous basis other than for things like water flows. We don't look at, for example, sediment and pollution loads quite to the degree we should do, and there's certainly lots of creeks where we have considerable landscape disturbances where there's basically, a minimal amount of assessment and monitoring.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you mentioned earlier, you've been involved in several research projects to do with the disturbances in the Nechaco and various watersheds. Would you be able to elaborate on the purpose and goals of some of these projects?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, most of the work we're trying to do is to understand how landscapes respond to disturbance and to try and provide some sort of guidance where possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I can give you certainly a couple of examples. So in the Nechaco watershed, for example, there's a lot of concern about sediment clogging some of the river gravels around the Vanderhoof area that the Nechaco white sturgeon use for spawning. So in the last sort of 7 to 8 years, we've tried to look at where that sediment is coming from, that the sediment that's getting into those spawning gravels near Vanderhoof. And we've looked at sort of the areas that have been affected by, for example, forest harvesting and agriculture. And we're also looking at the effects of erosion of the channel banks along the Nechaco which are both a function of changes in precipitation, as well as the operation of the Kenny Dam, which regulates and modifies the stream flow. And, you know, one of the things that we've been doing is using an approach called sediment source fingerprinting. And in this particular case, what you do is you look at the composition of the sediment, so its mineralogy or its chemical composition, or sometimes you can even digitize its sort of its color properties. And then we've been using a numerical model to basically identify where that sediment is coming from. And then obviously, for such a large watershed like the Nachaco, if you can identify where it's coming from, if it's coming from an area that's affected by forestry activities, for example, then you can provide guidance as to certain mitigation measures that can be put in place to try and stop that forest harvesting, for example, or that agricultural activity from causing erosion and sediment delivery to watersheds. And then in the last year, we've been expanding the work in the Nachaco a little bit by looking at, for example, the lake of the effect of the Shovel Lake wildfire. So obviously, you can imagine you get these big wildfires, they burn up all the vegetation cover, you've got these exposed soils, there's nothing stopping that rainfall from impacting the landscape. So we're trying to look at it, does that cause enhanced erosion and sediment delivery to creeks downstream? And then also, are we getting some increased pollution coming off that landscape? So for example, there's a certain type of compound, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, that get introduced into both the atmosphere, into soils and waters when you have a wildfire. So are these big wildfires causing more sediment pollution getting into creeks? So that's one piece of work that we're doing in the Nachaco, and we're also doing other work in other parts of the province and other parts of Canada. So for example, we're working in Manitoba, looking at the Nelson River system and Lake Winnipeg. So in lots of agricultural parts of North America and Europe, and indeed, you know, parts of BC as well, phosphorus coming off the landscape, getting into rivers and creeks, is a major problem. And Lake Winnipeg in Manitoba is a good example of that. It's a hyper-eutrophic system, meaning that it has an excessive amount of nutrients like phosphorus, which in turn cause things like algal blooms, and then they degrade the water quality of these waterways. And indeed, you know, eutrophication is an issue for lots of lakes and waterways in Canada. Tabor Lake near Prince George has got problems of eutrophication because of phosphorus. And then Lake Erie, the US-Canada border, is an example again, like Lake Winnipeg, of a really large lake that's basically gone hypereutrophic. So some of the work we're trying to do is trying to identify where the phosphorus is coming from, and a lot of that phosphorus is bound onto the sediment, like lots of other chemicals. Chemicals either sort of are dissolved in water or they're on sediment. So it's surprising actually how many chemicals like phosphorus and metals actually bound onto the sediment. So in the case of the work in Manitoba, we're trying to look at some of these watersheds that are draining into Lake Winnipeg to try and find where the sediment and the phosphorus is coming from. And then when we can do that, then one of the things we can do is we can then try and put forward some of these mitigation measures that would apply to most of the landscape disturbances that I've been talking about today. So, for example, we can put riparian grass strips in, which provide a mechanism to basically decouple the landscape from the river network, and those riparian buffers help to strip out the sediment and the phosphorus and any other contaminants like the pesticides that might be on that. So, you know, it's an example there of work we're doing that has a sort of a mitigation aspect to it as well. And indeed, you know, I would say that, you know, the role of most environmental scientists like myself is to try to understand how environmental systems function and then use that knowledge and try to help society to live in a sustainable way without compromising aspects of the planet that we need to survive, like soils and water and air.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions as to resources, perhaps, for individuals who are interested to learn more on these topics but don't necessarily come from an environmental science background?
Well, like with most things these days, search engines like Google are really very useful. I mean, you can type in keywords, and typically those search engines will come up with a range of different articles or news outlets that a certain person could follow, which would then enable you to learn more about certain subjects on or issues on this subject.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Thank you so much for being here today and doing this interview with us.
Thank you very much, Al. I appreciate the opportunity to describe some of the work we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.